Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast. Today we are talking with Gareth Ross and Lucy Redding. They've just had a research paper published. It's called Comparing Social Climate Across Therapeutically Distinct Prison Wings. Gareth and Lucy, tell us a bit about yourselves.
Hi, David. So I'm a forensic psychologist. I work for the prison service. I've had several roles working in the prison service as a psychologist, I guess. I've worked with what you might call mainstream interventions, mainly CBT-style approaches to working with offending behaviour. I've got lots of experience of assessing and writing reports for the parole board. And I've also worked in sort of therapeutic interventions, therapeutic communities, enabling environments, those kinds of psychologically informed approaches. Yeah,
that's me. That's great. Thank you. So it's Gareth Ross. Thanks very much. And Lucy Redding.
Hi, David. I'm Lucy. I'm also a forensic psychologist working for HMPPS. I've been in the prison service for 12 years this year, and have my background's mainly in programs, CBT interventions, working with adult males, mainly who have committed violent offences. And currently I'm the delivery manager for a high intensity violence program called Kaizen.
Great, thanks very much. So what was it that interested you two about this particular topic and this research?
So I'm doing a PhD at the moment. So I'm looking at the relationship between prison environments and identity, specifically criminal social identity as kind of conceptualized by Dan Bodisek and his colleagues, and enabling environments, and really what effect living in enabling environments might have on someone's personal identity and the level that they might identify with a kind of criminal sort of sensibility. But my plan is to do that sort of over a long period of time. But that also kind of afforded the opportunity for us to do some consultancy with the prison and do a kind of snapshot of the social climate in like a moment in time. And in doing that, to compare some of the distinct kind of wings that we have at the prison where we work. And doing that was something that Lucy led on. We kind of collaborated with that, and she kind of took the reins and developed the project.
So, because rehab culture is becoming more of a hot topic, I guess, in prisons at the moment, we had a rehab culture committee start up at Gartree, and we just felt it was really important to have a good understanding of what is the culture or the climate like right now before we can really make any massive changes or begin any projects. We wanted to know what our baseline was, so we felt that it'd be really important to do this project as part of a starting of the rehab culture committee, and really building upon that from the outcome of the research.
For me as well, like working in different parts of the same prison, I was really aware that it felt like they're very different. The atmosphere could feel really different from, you know, one wing to another, in ways I could describe, though sometimes it was intangible. But I was really interested to see if it was possible to kind of measure that in a way that might be, I suppose, more scientific or more observable than just a kind of clinical experience. And so the essences measure that we used in the study was kind of a chance to do that, really. So that was, that was part of the interest, I think, in the area.
That's great, because I think it's the intangible that we're really interested in pursuing and tracking down. Tell us a bit about your prison.
So it's a Category B prison within the long-term high security estate, and we hold about 700 residents who are all serving a life sentence of some kind, whether it's mandatory, discretionary, or an indeterminate sentence for public protection. It's a pretty static population. We have guys there for a long, long time, many, many years, who some of them are quite comfortable and quite happy there. Especially if they're serving quite a long sentence as well. And as Gareth just sort of started to allude to there, we've got quite different units at this prison. So we've got three units that are part of the OPD pathway, so the Offender Personality Disorder pathway. We have a TC, a TC plus, and we have a pipe, and that's a progression pipe. So for people who have already completed their core interventions, if you like. And then we have our mainstream units as well. So we've got eight other wings at this prison. So there's about 600 people on the mainstream part of the prison, and then 100 split between the TC plus, the TC and the pipe. So we felt, again, just that the previous research only really looked at whole prisons that were rehabilitative or therapeutic, if you like, versus whole prisons that maybe didn't have as much of that. So what was quite unique about this project was that we were looking at the therapeutic wings and the mainstream wings within one site, and the real different experiences that people can have going between those wings. So that was another kind of USP, if you like, of the research.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that's really interesting about the research, is the fact that you are looking at how things compare from one service to another, where you know, the what's offered is very, very different to the men or you know, service users. And the fact that you've picked up on Gareth's observation that there's something felt different working in those different places. One of the things I really enjoyed about your paper is there's a really lovely observation at the start about some of the really small nuances of prison life that remind everyone of the power differences that rarely get spoken of outside. So I was thinking, you talk about, you make observations about the language that's used and very small humiliations, such as having to ask for a toilet roll, for instance. And I wondered what impact you thought those kind of like small, petty humiliations have on a prisoner's well-being and resilience, you know, when you're living in that kind of environment for years.
Yeah, thank you. I think, like for me, really what is at the heart of a lot of that is a sort of sense of disempowerment and, you know, really sort of infantilizing almost the population, keeping them under sort of subjugation. And that really speaks to a kind of giving people a lack of autonomy or control over their, you know, their day-to-day living, the decisions that they make. And, you know, that sense of autonomy is obviously really important for a person's resilience. And taking that away, you know, has negative implications. And I think one of the, I guess we might come to this, but maybe one of the differences between sort of mainstream locations and the more sort of enabling environments are that, where as much as possible in those environments, the service users are given the opportunity to have as much autonomy as possible within the sort of wider prison rules, if you like. And I think the other thing is really, it's a kind of constant reminder of the past and of the place where the men have come from. And it, rather than a sort of future focus on someone's ability or someone's potential, or so perhaps positive changes to identity or a new kind of life narrative, it kind of, I think it serves to keep people placed in the kind of, if you like, offender narrative, which is, you know, contrary to the aims of the service ultimately. And so I think they're the to me, to my mind, they're two of the most striking kind of impacts, if you like, of that sort of day-to-day disempowerment.
Mm. Yes, thank you. And I suppose what that led to for me was a kind of reflection on the language, and knowing myself, having, you know, worked in prisons for a long time, that over time staff often start using language that is very natural for the prison, like talking about feeding and shipping people out, you know, which is language which is really, you know, conjures up the image of cattle rather than human beings. I suppose it's really striking that you both work in a prison and have worked there for a long time, but you still notice these things, whereas lots of prison staff, I think, kind of naturalise to the prison setting. So I was wondering how you managed to hold on to that sense of what's not normal.
I think some things have always felt not normal, even from, you know, just joining the service. It always felt unusual to me to be calling people by their surnames. I still regularly get called Miss on the wings. I always find that odd. You know, I'm not a teacher. I have a name. And I think, you know, the background that you have from a, you know, working in psychology or doing a psychology degree, you carry with that, you know, empathy and compassion and wanting to learn more about people and seeing people as human beings. I think it is easy to get carried away and to fit in, I guess, with some of that prison language, and you do get desensitized to the environment for sure, you know, with the keys and what you can and can't take in. It is an abnormal environment to work in, let alone to live in. But I think what helps you to keep things not normal in mind is your supervision, discussions with your colleagues and your peers, and just keeping on top of, you know, the literature and being curious to learn more and read more all the time, and understanding why seeing people in prison as offenders versus seeing them as people is, you know, it's just key in terms of trying to understand how to help people change and improve, and why not doing those things has a negative impact.
I think we all have a, I think that, you know, the naturalisation, I think we all have a desire to fit in and belong, don't we? And I wonder if there's something about you guys that means there's a strength in you that makes it possible to resist that pressure to just conform and just use the language that's used within the prison and stick with noticing the stuff that isn't normal.
Perhaps I think that's that I would like to think so. I think it is not always easy though, and I think like for me, working in particular in the kind of more relational environments like a therapeutic community where there is that opportunity to really, you know, get to know our clients as individuals, as people who are rounded and are more than just a collection of risk factors, really kind of has helped me in my career kind of to keep that in mind, as well as any, you know, personal strengths I might have. And I think it sort of does somewhat depend on what kind of career someone has within the service and what kind of opportunities they have. It kind of makes a difference, I think, to how they might then perceive you know, the clients.
Could you say a bit more about that?
I think some roles might lend themselves more to some of the processes, like where we might dehumanize clients. Some of our, as within psychology, say, some of our processes are very regimented, very manualized. Our risk assessments are often, structured and you know, based around ultimately sort of groups and group norms and we sort of research literature. And while we might spend time getting to know an individual to help us with a formulation, it's, you know, with a relatively tight time scale, and it's very different from being in an environment where you might get to know someone over a period of several years, and you might share with them in their triumphs and despairs when they've perhaps their family members, they have problems with outside, or, you know, you see them progress from one environment to another, or you might see change over a longer period of time. So I think some roles and some situations within the places that we work do lend themselves more to, I suppose, enabling our empathy to become more a part of how we define ourselves as professionals, rather than the kind of maybe more technical skills around, say, risk assessment, for instance. And not everyone has that kind of diversity of role or opportunity. So there's perhaps something there in maybe the way that we train psychologists, or in the way that different people work, that might, I think, would influence then how they understand different kinds of things. If that makes sense.
Thank you. Yes, it does. It does. And one of the things that you talk about within your paper is the difference between culture and climate. And I wondered, and what impact these have on resilience. I wondered, do you think one's more implicated than the other?
I think it's. I think they're both very important. Obviously, I think to distinguish between the two, that what we use in the paper is the idea that climate is perhaps more subjective, more malleable, whereas, you know, culture is more stable and entrenched, and you wouldn't expect a climate to change drastically from one moment to the next or one day to the next. You'd expect some stability, but also it might be possible, more possible to change and to be more distinct between one place and another within the same organisation, as we found in this study. And I think that in reality they will both influence one another. I think the culture is perhaps, you know, sets the parameters of what might be achievable, and you know, the climate within that can change, but the influence can be two ways. And similarly, the wider, if you have the culture of an organization is what we're talking about, then the culture of the system above that will also sort of influence things, and the culture of the country as a whole, you know. And going down more narrowly, within the climate, there would be subgroups and individuals that actually can influence things kind of going upwards as well. So I think it's kind of a multi-systemic thing, ultimately.
So if you're talking about climate, are you kind of talking about the atmosphere of what's going on in that, at that moment, at that point in time?
Yeah, yeah. The atmosphere, the feel.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. We wanted to talk a bit about the... your research findings now. Can you say a bit about your overall findings?
Yeah, sure. So the first key research question was looking at whether or not the perceived social climate on the therapeutic wings differs compared to the social climate on the mainstream wings. And what we found was across the board, for the essences, is made up of three subscales. So for each of the subscales, the therapeutic wings rated the social climate far more positively than the mainstream wings, which fitted in with our hypotheses that that would be the case. What we also did, the second question, was to look at whether or not the staff and the residents differed in terms of their perceptions of social climate. And we pulled all staff and all residents for this analysis. And what we found was that staff perceptions of the social climate overall were more positive than the residents. But what was interesting was that when you broke that down further into the subscales, so one of the scales looks at the sort of cohesion between residents, so we called that peer support. So there were no real differences in how staff or residents saw peer support. But when we got to safety, so how safe people in the prison feel, the residents rated themselves feeling slightly more safe than the staff. But I guess the key thing to compare that against was the essence's norms. And overall, it was found that mainly everybody felt, I think it was clearly below average in terms of levels of safety. So if everybody's feeling clearly below average, it was just that residents felt slightly safer within that category. And then finally, we looked at staff prisoner or staff resident relationships, and staff rated themselves as supportive. Residents disagreed with that. So there was a disconnect there with those ratings, which would have been really good to unpick a little bit more, you know, through qualitative research. But we didn't do that as part of the research study. And then we did a supplementary analysis that literally tracked each wing. And so we pulled everybody, all staff, all residents for each wing, and did a comparison of how the social climate felt. And again, I think if I'd have plotted it before, it probably would have come out fairly in line with the results. And again, we just saw that the mainstream wings were pretty low in terms of their social climate. We had a real dip when we went into the segregation unit. And then it really peaked when you got to the rehabilitation wings or the therapeutic wings. So kind of fitted in line with our hypotheses.
Right. That's very interesting, isn't it? So one of the first points that you made there was that both residents and staff felt below average in terms of safety. So that's in relation to other prisons or other forensic units, is it?
That was other UK Cat B prisons.
Right.
I'm pretty sure. Gareth?
Yes. Right. What I would say about the norms, though, is the norms were taken a few years ago. Mm. And so I'd be curious to see if they are updated, whether the norms would look slightly different based on the observation of, you know, increased levels of violent incidents and other problematic behaviour that we've seen in prisons over the last few years. So that would be my speculation, but I don't know if that's the case or not.
Sorry, it'd be so interesting to find out.
Yes.
It would, but if you just took the norms, it's perhaps making some kind of comment about the prison overall.
It is, yeah. Perhaps. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to speculate now, because one of your findings was that prisoners felt less supported by staff than staff felt that they were supportive. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is?
Something that I wrote about in the paper was the items on the essences were quite interesting. And I think if I'd have gone down to an item level analysis, it might have pulled out some other interesting differences, because some of the items on the subscale spoke about, you know, I give time to the resident. But then another item said something like, I know that staff know the resident's histories well. So both of those items are in the same scale. So I think staff could probably confidently say that they do give the residents a lot of time, and that, you know, they deal with day-to-day issues, day-to-day problems. But I think when you're going maybe a little bit deeper in terms of, do they really know the residents? And I think on the mainstream wings, there just isn't that time necessarily to get to know as many people as you'd like to know. We also did this research before the OMIC model came in and key workers came sort of back online, if you like. So I'd be curious to see, and we're planning to keep repeating this research, where we're at now with that, because I think with key workers becoming more involved with the residents, that knowledge of the men will really increase. And I think that will help the residents to feel more supported by staff, because there'll just be better relationships overall. But that was only my hypothesis. The items were quite different in that subscale. So that was my best guess.
Great, thanks very much. Do you think you notice any difference between the therapeutic communities and the pipe?
There was no statistical significant difference between the TCs and the pipe. The pipe did come out highest when you really picked apart the data, which may well be because it's a progression pipe at this prison, so people have done all of their core treatment, whereas obviously on the TC and the TC Plus, they're in the middle of some really intense work, and so there might be some level of difference, I guess, in how safe they feel or how supported they feel by each other or by staff, whereas perhaps when you come onto the pipe, when you've finished everything, things feel a bit better and you're feeling a bit more positive that you're moving forwards. But there was no statistical difference between them. They all were rated good.
Hmm. So, well, that's very interesting, isn't it? Because it kind of suggests that, at least in terms of these items, it's to do with the relationship, the relational aspect, rather than the therapeutic practice, which makes the difference.
Yeah, and I think that was sort of the big conclusion that we drew from the research, was that the TC, the TC Plus and the pipe are all underpinned by core principles, you know, whether that's the EE standards specifically or not, but there's, you know, relational workings at the heart of all of those units, and just makes such a massive difference when you physically go onto the unit versus going onto one of the mainstream wings. Like Gareth was saying earlier, you can really feel the difference. And, you know, the staff working on each of those units have enhanced training, their access to support and supervision and training is far greater than what it is for the staff on the mainstream wings, which I think makes a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. I think it's the very much a lot of the time it is a question of how things are done and the processes that are involved on the wings, rather than the kind of what is actually being done, and the sort of differences between the timetabling, for instance. I'd be really interested, and I'm not sure we're going to get the permission to do it, but we might soon, to replicate the study now. So as the moment that we're speaking, with the kind of restrictions due to the pandemic, the day-to-day activities on the wings have never been more similar. The regime is essentially the same. So it would be really interesting to see if these differences persist across several months of identical regimes. And if so, that would lend further support to what you said there, David, about it being more about something to do with the relationships and the processes, the way things are done, as much as it is about what might be being done at the time. So, yes.
Mm. Hey, get the chance to do that. That seems like really quite crucial research, actually. So, and it's a, hopefully it's a once in a lifetime opportunity.
Slightly straying. Did you get any opportunity to look at the segregation unit? It's probably not called that, of course, but and the relationships there and how they compared to other parts of the prison?
Yeah, we did look at the segregation unit, and the social climate came out the worst from compared to all of the wings. We didn't get loads of responses, more responses from staff than we did from the people that were in the segregation unit at that point. I think possibly only one or two people from potentially 10 to 12 cells, I think we have down there. So yeah, it was difficult to reach those people to really take part and get them involved in that. The interesting thing that we did get from the analysis was that of the three subscales on the essences, so safety was low, peer support was low, you know, they're not interacting with anybody, but staff support was rated the highest out of the three scales. Now, that was mainly completed by staff, so potentially it's not, you know, the most accurate view. But again, in terms of the ratings given on there, you know, they do spend a lot of time talking to the guys that are down there, and a lot of effort does go in. So it would have been interesting to have a few more responses from the residents that were down there at the time. And I think that's something for future research. We can think more about how we would engage with those people. And, you know, a questionnaire probably isn't the best way to do that. And, you know, more qualitative research would be better for those people.
Thank you. Your paper begins by saying that rehabilitation is one of the key priorities of the prison service, and you draw attention to the prison service's ethos of safety, decency, hope and optimism. So do you think these are all important characteristics for resilience and the building of relationships?
Yes, I think it goes without saying that those are all essential in terms of building resilience. And I think people need to have that sense of safety before, you know, they can grow. And I think a lot of people talk about life in prison is about survival and it treading water and getting by. And I think when you're in that survival mode, there is no real room for growth and for thriving. You know, a lot of definitions of resilience are about thriving. And I think when you haven't got that sense of safety, there's just very little chance to try and really thrive and change and do things differently for yourself.
Absolutely. I think you captured that really nicely there. And, you know, the prison service is obviously trying to push the agenda around providing trauma-informed environments, isn't it? But I suppose it's most basic. That is about helping people feel safe while they're in prison. And unless you can do that, it feels impossible to achieve some of these other things, doesn't it? About real fundamental change and growth, as you say.
So we had some general questions, really, about the culture of the prison service, and how far do you think the aspirations, as we just mentioned, are in conflict with the underlying culture, and which is the best way to change that? Do you think the culture needs changing as a whole, or can it be changed by the influence of discrete units like the ones you looked at?
Well, I mean, so there's a few things there, I guess. I think there can be a conflict between a wider culture and efforts to instill rehabilitative ideals, trauma-informed practice, you know, relational working, those kinds of things. Nevertheless, I think they are really, you know, crucial kind of mission statements, if you like, and I think really important for the service to keep in mind, even if, you know, it can seem maybe ambitious, maybe even overly ambitious sometimes when you're faced with some of the brutal realities of prison life. But I think it's really important to hold on to those goals, because if you don't, then what are you left with? I mean, there's a danger of just succumbing to a kind of hopelessness and a kind of pessimistic institutional narrative that will just lead to far worse outcomes than a perhaps not quite realized ideal. So I think it's important to be not to hide from the realities of prison life and what it is, and not to pretend that everything is as intended, because that would be, you know, unrealistic. But I think the aspirations are worth keeping in mind. I think they're not worth keeping in mind. I think they're essential. Which influences the other one another, I think they're both very important. It's kind of a question of both, not either or. I think it is possible to have pockets of rehabilitation in a wider culture that is less supportive or less rehabilitative, as in fact this study provides some evidence for. However, you know, you really do need the organizational support to help those pockets thrive. Otherwise, they could become, you know, more isolated, countercultural, be seen as maybe even subversive, and the influence that they can have on the wider organizational establishment will be lost. So I think you need to have those pockets, because people need to see that working. People need to see how that can be effective. But it also needs to be supported by clear culture from the top. So I think you have to, it's almost like a cultural sort of pincer movement. You need to attack from both sides to make anything happen. And one without the other is kind of hopeless, really.
Thank you.
I really like the idea about the pincer movement and needing to have both, so that things are kind of moving forward in very slow but steady ways. It's a really great way of encapsulating that.
Thank you.
Well, one of the interesting suggestions that you made earlier was that you make in your paper, actually, where you're talking about safety, is the idea that actually feeling less safe might be functional for staff. And I wondered if you could say a little bit more about that.
So I guess just to repeat the finding, it was that most people felt unsafe or clearly below average, the rating was, but the residents felt slightly safer than the members of staff. So that was something that was found in other research as well that's been conducted using the essences, both in the UK and abroad, that typically residents do feel slightly safer than staff. And I think staff feeling less safe is probably reflective of, you know, the levels of violence have increased in this prison and in prisons generally. And the, you know, the function of prison is really different for staff and residents. And for staff, you know, we get to go home at the end of the day. And for residents, particularly serving long sentences at this prison, you know, you have to adapt and you have to be able to survive. And I think staff don't have that same need that needs filling for that survival. So I think certainly the residents, you know, develop ways to achieve that, where staff probably don't. But also, I sort of hypothesised in the paper as to whether if staff feel less safe, does that sort of counter against any complacency? And almost keeping, if staff feel a little bit on the back foot, if you like, will they work harder to sort of strive to maintain levels of safety and security? But I guess the flip side of that is that the therapeutic wings, you know, reported feeling safe and they're not complacent. And what's interesting with those wings is that, again, that relational working and the dynamic security is probably what contributes to making those wings feel safer. So it's a really difficult finding to really explain and get to the bottom of, because you can sort of see how it could be functional to be on the back foot and to be working hard to like try and keep up with them, if you like, keep up with the residents, but that's just not seen on the other wings. So
do you think that's, I know myself working on a therapeutic wing, that there's more of a focus for staff on having to see both parts to the person, so having to very much be able to see the offender, but also when you're dealing with the prisoner's own personal trauma from the past, that you also see their vulnerability at the same time, and and whether staff in the therapeutic services are more capable of seeing those two different parts and making sense of them.
Potentially, and I think it's something I haven't worked on therapeutic wings in our prison, but I know that even from working on programs, you know, members of staff get really caught up in sometimes, you know, you've really gotten to know this person and then they tell you something that is, you know, quite risky either to themselves or to other people, and it's trying to work through that with them, but also, you know, bearing in mind, you know, the prison processes that you have in place as well. And I think there's a real balance between maintaining boundaries and trust, but also using the prison processes that you've got in place to report risk and whatnot. And I think that's a really fine line, and one that the therapeutic wings probably are better set up to contain and manage than the mainstream wings.
I agree. And I think that is probably a function of the deeper relationships that you just are afforded because of the informal time. It's not only a relationship in a kind of classroom context, it's a relationship where people are seeing the staff every day and they have opportunities to get to know one another. And I think keeping in mind the offender as victim, it does change the dynamic from what is maybe more automatically or ordinarily seen, where offenders or residents might be seen as only offenders, or like I said earlier, sort of collections of risk factors rather than whole people. And I think that yes, the dynamic is very different, because the staff will see the vulnerability of the men. We want the men to see their own vulnerability, and also the staff to be more conscious of their own vulnerability. In working with people relationally, how exactly that contributes to feelings of safety is like Lucy said, is a little bit we're not certain about that, but it certainly is, I think, one of the key differences between those wings and mainstream locations.
Yeah, and you can really see how there's a functionality to staff in being aware of their lack of safety. And certainly one of the things that we do is we encourage staff to talk about their feelings of fear within the service. But I'm curious about what then that means for staff resilience, and maybe that's different in services where you allow for more authenticity and wholeness of the person, whether that be prisoner or staff, or working in other parts of the prison where perhaps you get people presenting in a more unidimensional way.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, the that kind of gets to the difference I was describing, I suppose, that sense of we are really encouraging in the more therapeutic units a wholeness, a sense of authenticity, a kind of demasking, if you like, of the bravado and the brick walls that both residents and staff will create to help keep themselves safe in the prison context, and often, you know, before the prison in kind of a adversarial lifestyle contexts. And I think part of the process of those units and the relational working is to allow those masks really to come down, those barriers to come down, so people can feel more authentic, more less offended, and more kind of more real, really, and more rounded as people with strengths and limitations. And I think that is true. That is what we try and achieve for staff and for the men. Yeah.
Thank you. And earlier, one of you, I think maybe you, Lucy, mentioned about the diversity of roles and how some roles are perhaps impacted upon more heavily. Being mindful of danger might be more functional in some roles. So that made me wonder, when you're talking about whether some roles are actually impacted more heavily in terms of resilience than other roles, you know, is it easier to be a psychologist in a prison, or is it easier to be an officer? I don't know. I wondered what your thoughts were.
It's really difficult. I think all roles in the prison carry their own challenges, and I think for me, I look at what the officers have to do on the mainstream wings and some of the things that they get involved in, and I don't envy them, and I think I couldn't do that, particularly when they don't have the support structures that we have in place. and that are in place on the therapeutic wing. So I think, you know, the officers, you know, undoubtedly have a risky job, and depending on where you work, you know, the therapeutic wings, I guess, bring their own challenges in that you are, you know, presenting a more vulnerable side of yourself, you know, both the staff and the residents, and that brings its own challenges. And, you know, particularly if staff aren't from a psychological background necessarily, I think that can be a real big change for some officers. So that can feel quite threatening. I think the environment, though, it is more containing and more supportive. So I guess for me, I would find being an officer on a mainstream wing one of the toughest jobs, probably.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You've both spent a lot of time in prisons. Do you think that's had an impact on your own sense of wellness, and how do you manage to maintain your own resilience?
That was that's a question that kind of does make me think, because I have myself sort of 17 years, I think, in the prison service, which is no small amount of time anymore. I think, you know, it can be very challenging. I think a lot of the time our role, or part of our role, is to hold the hope for other people and to kind of contain distress. And that does have a cost, I think. I think to be an effective practitioner in these environments, there is a kind of emotional investment. And I think there's a danger of becoming overly invested in kind of outcomes of whatever it might be, I suppose, whether that's a project that we're working on or the success of a man in therapy. And, you know, my experience is that will just become, you know, too much like a roller coaster, because you can never predict what things will work as you want them to and what things won't. And for sure, some things will and some things won't. So I guess I've always, or I've come to be more motivated by, I guess, maybe some kind of core values, a kind of curiosity. I want to know about people, and I want to know like what helps and why, and compassion, I guess. I think it's okay to care. I mean, it's almost a controversial subject sometimes in a prison context, but compassion is good. It's important to care and to kind of allow something of yourself as part of that process. And I think if you can be consistent with those motivations and those kind of values, then they can kind of provide a bit of stability no matter what fluctuations come. I find that helps. I think, you know, having good relationships with your colleagues, the good camaraderie as well as the supervision that we have as psychologists helps enormously. And I suppose for me, you know, it's been important to learn to recognize my own limits and to put boundaries around my work to make sure that I have enough energy and time to do the things outside of work that I enjoy doing, because they can be, you know, restorative for sure. So I think it's something that needs attending to for any member of staff working in these environments, because I have seen people have, you know, too much, it'd be too much for them after time. And so I am mindful of how we kind of, not just as individuals, but like structurally, create conditions that people can actually work and thrive in. I think it just needs attention, because without thoughts and systems, there is a real potential for burnout, I guess you could say, or for the effect of the work to become too much. But for me, I love my job. I find it very restoring. It gives me energy rather than takes away most of the time. And I feel lucky to kind of be working in the places that I am with the people that I do. So, yeah.
Lucy?
I think Gareth has put it across really well, better than I can. But yeah, I think the roller coaster is a really good analogy to use working in a prison. And I think particularly working at this prison, because you see, because they're such long on serving such long sentences, that immediate gratification that you might hope for when you join the service, that you're going to see change really quickly and what you're doing is going to change this person's life immediately. You know, you do get a bit of a, you know, bump down to reality when you see that it's just not as simple as that. So I think for me, seeing the work that you do is just one piece of a much bigger picture, seeing change, and you work more like a marathon than a sprint. And I think as well, what's difficult at our place is that because it's a Cat B, you know, you might see people, you see people move on to Cat C and, you know, to open and release. But after that, you don't necessarily necessarily hear much about them and hear many success stories, you know. And I think that's something that, it's something that I would have liked, but I think, like Gareth, you sort of come to change your expectations and modify, you know, what's realistic to achieve, and try not to place too many high expectations on yourself and on them. But of course, you know, there's times that the work does get difficult, and I think during those times it's just really important to use your peers and your supervision and learn from things that don't go too well, or that you take to heart. You learn not to take it so much to heart next time. And yeah, just like Gareth saying, looking after yourself. There's a book that I read once that was about resilience, actually, in terms of offering some support to staff, and it said something like how a singer would look after their voice and a carpenter would look after their tools. So, you know, a practitioner needs to look after themselves. And I thought that was a really nice way of remembering that everybody in the prison service, not just psychologists, but, you know, all members of staff really need to keep that in mind, because you would, in any other profession, you would look after those other things. And it seems like sometimes we put ourselves last. And if you're doing that, you're just not offering then a good service to the people that you're wanting to help.
A really lovely example, and both of you, I think, have been really kind of heartening in terms of your responses, that sense of realistic optimism in terms of the prison, your services, and also the men that you're working with. It's been really great to interview you both and have this conversation.
Thank you. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Yeah, great. So that's really very, very interesting. I think my main carry away out from this is something to do with your finding that relationships are key to developing a sense of well-being and safety. And in a way, that's rather optimistic, because building relationships should be one of the more easy things within a prison service. Of course, the therapy settings are important too, but overall, building up and developing good relationships sounds like a very sound beginning.
And I think, yeah, I think there's no reason why that can't happen on the mainstream wings. When I think the thing that got to kind of bugged me from the research, if you like, was that, you know, the therapeutic wings have got 100 people on, and the mainstream wings have got 600. And you think that's 600 people who are just having a worse experience of life, essentially. And I think that was just something that stuck with me, was just how it wouldn't take much to bring some of the values and the principles from those therapeutic wings onto the mainstream wings to sort of level the playing field a little bit. It feels a bit unfair that you've got 100 have a better chance, if you like, success and rehabilitation, and 600 that are just, yeah, treading water is a big thing that people talk about, and just surviving and getting by.
Yeah. Okay, thanks very much. One thing we did ask you is if you could give us some example, really, of something that's inspired you in your work, be it a paper, a book, piece of music. Did you have any thoughts on that?
I'll say a practitioner who passed away recently, Ruth Mann, who was one of my PhD supervisors, and who's writing about many things, but for me, rehabilitative culture, I found inspiring, and it's one of those people who helped me to retain that humanity that we spoke about earlier. And, you know, because she was constantly paying attention, I think, to the world around and being curious and keeping that sort of almost like, I don't know if it's the right word, but that naivety to experience, that allowed her to see things as they really are rather than get complacent. And I will always remember that from her.
That's very inspiring. Thanks, Gareth.
I remember reading a book before I joined this job when I was interested in doing something in this area. And somebody one of my friends, her dad was involved in restorative justice, and recommended a book called The Damage Done. And it's about a guy who was in and out of prison, you know, his whole life, lots of acquisitive offences, lots of substance use. And he got involved in the restorative justice programme, or, you know, process, met the victims. And it was a real turning point for him. And he's really changed his life. And I think it just showed me what prisons could do. And, you know, I like a bit of a biography, if you like, of people, you know, really making changes and just turning their lives around. And I think it just stuck with me as something that people can change and staff can be part of that process. And it was something that just, yeah, interested me and kind of reaffirmed that this was something that would be a really nice job to do.
Great. Well, thanks very much indeed, Lucy Redding and Gareth Ross. Been great speaking with you.
Thank you.
Well, that was so lovely meeting with Gareth and Lucy. And I suppose it really reminded me of another reason why I wanted to do this podcast, because I just think there are so many really brilliant people working within the prison system that just go about their business on a daily basis, offering something that's really valuable to the people who are living in prison. And I think it doesn't get spoken about or showcased enough. You know, we read big kind of like research projects, which get a lot of PR, but actually the day-to-day practice of people that are just kind of like doing their work in the prison doesn't really get much of a look in.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I think it's so nice hearing Lucy and Gareth, who I know actually from working with them at Gartree. And it reminds me how there are all these people working away in our prison service settings in what are actually, to most people, would seem pretty lousy conditions. So the conditions for psychologists at Gartree, they're not the best in the world. I mean, if you've watched TV programs about the executive suites and so on, it's not that, I can tell you, it's not that. But they seem to be absolutely focused on their work, absolutely aware of the security needs of the institution they're working in, but very concerned for the well-being of the staff they work with, the prison officers, and for the prisoners they were talking about.
Absolutely. And did it churn more questions for you of people, you know, things that would be interesting for us to explore during this, you know, during later episodes of the podcast?
Yeah, I thought one of the things they raised was that it was interesting to me, at any rate, was that the pipe, which is a non-treatment setting, had a slightly better atmosphere than the two TCs. And all three of them, of course, had a much better atmosphere than the rest of the prison. So that really said to me, what they're measuring is something about the relationships between the staff and the prisoners that they're working with. It was the relationship that's the key to all this.
Absolutely, and hopefully we can learn more about how those relationships function and where the strengths of those lie in future episodes. I think for me, there was also the, you know, is getting to know someone well over a longer period. Is that better for the well-being of both staff and prisoners? When you think about how quickly people can get moved from place to place in the prison system and all that change, which doesn't bring out the best of any of us, does it? So you can kind of see how, where they've built up relationships, how that's more fruitful.
Yeah, prisons are essentially very, very unstable places, and anyone can get moved at any time. Staff tend to be a bit more stable, but not necessarily. The key thing about all of those units they were talking about was that staff had some consistency and would work there over a fairly good length of time.
I suppose there was also that interesting notion that it's not what's done, but it's how it's done that's important, a bit like the Therapeutic Alliance. And be really interested to hear from other guests their take on that.
Great. And I hope that next week you'll all join us for our conversation with Liz Mulliner, who's the founder of the Heal for Life project in Australia and worldwide.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com, and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.